From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. At the Supreme Court, this is likely to be the hottest of the 3 days of arguments over the nation's health care law. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports the justices will focus today on whether Congress can require everyone to have health insurance.
The so-called individual mandate is at the heart of the health care law. It's the requirement that everyone have health insurance. The Obama administration says the entire system rests on the weight of the individual mandate because insurers can only guarantee coverage for people with expensive medical conditions if healthy people are in the pool, too. In court today, the law's opponents will argue that Congress cannot require everyone to buy a product. The law's defenders will say Congress acted within its rights when it passed the law. They argue that health coverage is different from any other product because everyone will use the health care system eventually. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
NPR's Craig Windham is outside the Supreme Court, where the demonstrations for and against the health care law he reported on yesterday continue. And Craig, what are you seeing today compared to yesterday?
Well, Paul, there are more people here today. More diverse viewpoints are represented. People chanting, waving signs. The crowd is so large, it's actually spilled over onto the grounds of the Capitol building across the street. Several members of Congress just hustled past me to get into the courthouse for the oral arguments today.
Craig, briefly, how does what you're finding today reflect polling data you've seen on people's feelings about the health care law?
Well, Paul, the diversity on display here today, I think, is a good reflection of the mixed opinion that polls show Americans have about the law. The new New York Times CBS survey shows the mandate requiring people to have health coverage is the least popular part of the law, but other aspects of the law have strong support, such as the requirement that health insurance companies cover people with existing medical conditions. But the survey finds that two-thirds of Americans want the Supreme Court to overturn at least part of the health care law.
Thanks. That's NPR's Craig Windham at the Supreme Court. Former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan says Syria has accepted his six-point peace plan. The BBC's Imogen Folks reports Annan says it's an initial step to ending the ongoing violence between government forces and government opponents in Syria.
Kofi Annan's plan calls for a UN-supervised halt to the fighting. It requires the Syrian government to pull its troops and heavy weapons out of cities such as Homs, and it will involve a daily two-hour humanitarian ceasefire with access for aid agencies to all areas affected by the fighting. Mr. Annan, who has been lobbying both Moscow and Beijing for their support to end the conflict, has welcomed Syria's letter accepting his plan, but he said actually implementing it will be the real test.
And that's the BBC's Imogen Folks reporting. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Economic Development Authority of Fairfax County, Virginia, home to creative people and creative solutions at powerofideas.org.
Good morning. I'm Steve Brown, WOSU News, at 10:04, 35 degrees. A new report says Ohio is meeting expectations for making changes to its education system that were a condition of a $400 million federal Race to the Top grant. The report from the Center for American Progress says Ohio's most significant achievement has been moving from a compliance-based system toward a support-based system during district reviews. It also points to efforts to create new ways to attract and develop teachers, adopt Common Core standards, and pilot a new teacher evaluation program. The report also says about 10% of all Ohio school districts have dropped out of the teacher evaluation program because of inadequate funding. About 160 soldiers are at this hour leaving a National Guard company in Mansfield to head to Afghanistan. The soldiers are part of the 1486th Transportation Company. A National Guard release says they will provide tactical ground distribution and resource support. State agriculture officials say a fungal disease that threatens a type of evergreen shrub has been found in Ohio for the first time. Boxwood blight was found at a Lake County farm, making Ohio the 10th state to report the plant disease. The discovery led to the burning of up to 10,000 infected boxwood plants and the leaf litter beneath them. The general manager of a nursery there says another 10,000 plants may also be burned as the nursery works to prevent the spread of the disease. A Southeast Ohio sheriff says a man facing eviction apparently killed his wife and then shot himself before calling authorities to report the murder-suicide. Athens County Sheriff Patrick Kelly says investigators found the pair dead at the home north of Athens yesterday morning. Currently 35 degrees in downtown Columbus. Expect sunny skies this morning with some clouds by afternoon, a high near 57 degrees today. At 6 minutes past 10 o'clock, I'm Steve Brown, WOSU News.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If this week's Supreme Court arguments is the Super Bowl in the legal fight over President Obama's health care overhaul, then perhaps yesterday's session was the pregame show. Yesterday, both the supporters and opponents of the Affordable Care Act agreed that the case should go forward. It was up to another attorney to argue that the case should be dismissed because the law has not been implemented yet, and people are not yet being fined or taxed, depending on how you interpret that, for not buying private health insurance. Today's arguments get to what many consider the heart of the debate. Does the Constitution permit the government to force citizens to buy private health insurance? Yesterday's proceedings were, in a word, boring. Take this exchange between Justice Elena Kagan and U.S. Solicitor General Donald Verrilli.
So Reed Elsevier seems in multiple respects on all fours with this case. Why is that wrong?
I don't think so, Justice Kagan. We think the closest analog is the very next provision in the United States Code, 7422A, which this court has held as jurisdictional and is phrased in exactly the same way as 7421A.
7428A. Know it well. Peter Shane is joining us to interpret that. Peter Shane is an Ohio State University law professor. He joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he is a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you. I have to stop laughing about that exchange between Justice Kagan and General Verrilli.
Did you listen to it? Have you listened to the entire...
No, I have read a good bit of the argument. The Supreme Court issued a transcript. I have to say it is not much more entertaining
in print than it is in real life. Yesterday's arguments focused on the part of the law that imposes a financial penalty on people who do not buy private health insurance. And some argued that the case should be dismissed because the government has not yet started collecting that penalty or tax because the law has not been implemented. The question was, ultimately, was that penalty a tax?
Right. So actually, in the 19th century, Congress enacted a statute called the Anti-Injunction Act, which generally requires that before people go to court in order to challenge the legality of a tax, that they pay it and then challenge the tax administratively and then go to court. And the obvious reason for this is if people could challenge taxes before they were actually imposed, it would create an enormous incentive for taxpayers to try to delay their tax liability indefinitely simply by litigating. And the argument that was made here is that because the penalty for not purchasing health insurance is a penalty that will be collected by the IRS, and indeed your accounting for your compliance will be done through the IRS, that this ought to be viewed as a tax that's subject to that limitation on litigating.
Now, the Supreme Court didn't have to rule on that before they take on the other issues, though, right?
Well, the court is obviously going to be entertaining argument on all of the four big issues that they have solicited briefs on. Mm-hmm. A part of the argument yesterday, there were really two arguments. One argument was, should the mandate penalty be viewed as a tax covered by the Act? And then for the really exciting part of the argument, there was also a discussion, and this is what you just heard Justice Kagan talking about, whether the statute is jurisdictional. That is to say, even if the statute covers this, is this something that the court can waive? Can the court say this is an extraordinary matter that we have decided on balance to resolve? Or is it, as lawyers would say, jurisdictional? That is, Congress intends for cases that fall under the statute to be outside the power of the courts to decide. And if it's in that category, then when the court writes its opinion, it would have to decide that question first. That is, it has to decide it has jurisdiction before it can properly address the other questions.
My guest is Peter Shane. He's an Ohio State University law professor. He joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he is a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. Peter, is there any chance the justices will dismiss this case until the law is fully in place? What's your take on that?
I think the short answer is no. The long answer is no. because, first, there is just too much ambiguity in the statute, and frankly, both the United States and the challengers to the law agree that the Anti-Injunction Act shouldn't apply. The court, in order to get the issue briefed, had to basically appoint private counsel to make the argument. There was one opinion. There actually were two lower court opinions that would have gone off on this issue, one a dissenting opinion in the D.C. Circuit, and then there was an opinion in the Fourth Circuit. But my judgment is that the court understands that this is an enormously weighty matter. It just would not make sense to me that the court would not only take cert in this case, as we say, but grant 6 hours of argument and then dispose of it on this kind of technicality.
It's expected to be a close decision either way, perhaps 5-4 decision. Based on the questions they asked yesterday and what you've read about it, did any of the justices tip their hands as to how they might rule on the case? Any insights overall from yesterday's?
Well, if you were looking, first of all, I guess I would want to be in the camp that says we don't really know how this case is going to come out. I think it could be a 5-4 case either way, but it could also be a 6-3 or 8-1 case upholding the law. So it may not be that close.
Mm-hmm.
The closest I would say somebody came to, I don't know, showing a card was Justice Alito. And again, this is a little obscure, but the government is arguing that not only does the so-called Commerce Clause empower Congress to enact this statute, but that the statute could also be upheld under Congress's taxing power. And Justice Alito observed that there seemed to be some inconsistency in the government saying this is not a tax statute that has to await litigation under the Anti-Injunction Act, but it is somehow something authorized by Congress's taxing power, if that makes sense. And that at least suggests that at least Justice Alito, who I'm gathering does not regard this as a tax and therefore not barred by the Anti-Injunction Act, mm-hmm. is probably also going to say that the taxing power issue, if he were asked to rely on the taxing power as a source of power for the mandate, would probably reject that argument. But that tells you nothing about the commerce argument.
Today, the justices are supposed to get to the heart of the matter for a lot of people, the health insurance mandate. As a close observer of the Supreme Court, and from where you sit, what are you looking for? What are you expecting they're going to talk about today?
There are two concerns, I think, that have been raised to some level of seriousness by the challengers to the statute. And I guess what I would listen for would be the way in which the judges address these two things. So one is this action-inaction distinction. One of the arguments that's been made against the mandate is that it is an impermissible extension of the power to regulate commerce to regulate people's decision to stay out of commerce, that this is, you know, action forcing rather than action regulating. Now, to be blunt, I think this argument is not a very powerful one because the decision not to buy insurance can simply be characterized as a decision, as an economic decision to self-insure. Self-insurance is an action. It's not inaction, but it would be interesting to see if the justices pick up on that to any extent. The argument that has gotten less attention to some extent in the press, but I think might be more serious, is the question of limitations. That is, I would expect the challengers to the law to say to the court, in effect, if Congress can make Americans do this, why can't they make Americans, you know, eat broccoli or run marathons or do anything else that Congress determines would make us a healthier country. And I think there's a very persuasive answer to that. But the court has been concerned, especially, I would say, since the mid-90s, with this question of limitations. And I think if you hear the justices asking a lot of questions that basically say, well, if we allow this, where does it stop? That might suggest a certain antsiness about upholding the mandate. Although, again, it's very you can't easily assume from what questions are asked what the judge's outcome will be.
Well, I guess the question I have then is the concern about health care, health, or is it about who pays for health care?
Right. So that's exactly the point. The reason for the mandate is not because it works to the benefit of each person who is buying insurance. The reason for the mandate is because right now we are spending nearly $1 trillion a year on uncompensated health care for the uninsured, which is an enormous drain on the economy and basically raises health costs for everyone else. So the reason I'm being required to buy health insurance is not because it's like my eating broccoli. It's so that when I need health care, I am not going to drive up your health care costs by you know, showing up without insurance and being unable to pay. So that, and I think what the government's going to say is that this is simply different from the, you know, the broccoli hypothetical, because we're talking about an economic market in which costs are transferred from the non-payers to those people who do pay, and that it is a unique market because it is a market that we can be absolutely certain everyone is going to have to participate in at some point during their lives. And one of the interesting things about this, and Judge Sutton, a proud Ohio State graduate, I would add.
Jeffrey Sutton?
Jeffrey Sutton.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things he said in concurrence in the Sixth Circuit case is, again, he made the point about insurance, the decision to self-insure being action, not inaction. But he also said that even if, you know, a lot of Americans sort of instinctively have anxiety about the government telling them to do something, that the economic impact of this law was undeniable. And even the challengers to the law conceded that Congress would have the power, the moment you walked into an emergency room, to make you buy insurance. So the only effect of this law, you could look, say, is one of timing. That is, it says to you, you have to buy health insurance, and you cannot wait until you're in the doctor's office to do it. And when you put it that way, it doesn't really sound like such an infringement on human liberty.
You know, both sides, of course, have submitted briefs. Ohio and other states have submitted supporting documents, as has advocacy groups. I mean, there's something like 123 or more amicus briefs have been submitted. How important are all of these briefs versus the oral arguments? What has bigger sway?
Well, you know, I've neither served on the court nor clerked for a Supreme Court justice. When I clerked for a Court of Appeals judge, I would say that there's no question that the judge for whom I clerked paid most attention to the briefs submitted by the parties. It's not that the amicus briefs got no attention, but really, again, the judge I knew best definitely put greatest weight on the briefs by the actual parties. My sense of oral argument, and lawyers undoubtedly think about this very differently, oral arguments are where cases are lost but not won. That is to say, a justice who walks into the court, justices walk into these arguments, I'm quite sure, with some inclination as to how they're going to come out. And what they're listening for is whether they just missed something, whether they missed something big. And so if a judge or a justice, you know, here's the person who is arguing for the position to which the judge is sympathetic, really unable to respond to a challenging question, that could, I think, force a judge or justice to rethink. But I think unless the parties have persuaded the judge or justice based on the writing, an oral argument's not going to make up for a weak brief.
Peter Shane, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Peter Shane is a professor of law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. He's also a visiting professor right now at Harvard Law School. Coming up, we're going to talk about online journalism, the future of online journalism, and especially the future of local online journalism. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and tune to our station tonight at 8 for special coverage. The U.S. Supreme Court considers the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. It's one of the most important legal and policy cases of our generation. Join host Jennifer Ludden for a recap of the day's arguments. That's special coverage from NPR News, The Supreme Court Debates Healthcare. Tonight at 8, right here on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
38 degrees in downtown Columbus, mostly sunny skies today with a few clouds building in the afternoon, a high near 58. There is a slight chance of rain for tonight, a low of 49 degrees. Showers are likely for tomorrow, but it'll be a warmer day with a high near 72. Overnight, a low of 42 degrees with a decreasing chance of rain. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
According to the Pew Research Center, more than three-quarters of American adults own a desktop or laptop computer. And of those, more than two-thirds use those devices to get their news. And more than half use their smartphone or tablet. The mainstream consumption of online news is a given now. So what remains unclear is the future, especially when it comes to local news. What might it look like? Will it even exist as we know it 10 years from now? Coming up later this week, the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law is sponsoring a two-day event called the Future of Online Journalism Symposium. Joining us right now is one of the presenters at that event. Michelle McClellan is a journalist and consultant who works on projects that help foster what she refers to as a healthy local news ecosystem. 2 years ago, she founded Block by Block Community News Summit, a network of small entrepreneurial local news sites. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thank you. Thank you. Great to be here.
I wanted to get right to that idea of a healthy local news ecosystem and what you mean by that.
I think as an ecosystem or community, a physical geographic community where members of the public have access to quality news and information. So it's less about the system and it's more about how the system can serve the public.
The word quality is the ultimate gray area, isn't it?
Yeah. I think that's a very good point. I think that I come out of the newspaper business and as an editor for almost 30 years, and I think we journalists tend to look at quality very much with a focus on craft, which is significant. But I think that when you start looking at what the public needs, relevance and utility may be better sort of standards by which to judge news and information.
Yeah, it's not really an either-or thing. In some ways, the online world has enhanced, obviously, people's access to information.
Absolutely. There's definitely greater access, greater not only to the information, but greater ability to provide and share information on the part of the public.
In 2010, the internet passed newspapers for the first time as the platform where Americans regularly get news, according to the survey data from the Pew Research Center and the information that I quoted a little bit earlier. Does that mean they're also getting different news?
It could mean that. I mean, it's so diverse that it varies from person to person. But, you know, I think you can view that through a negative prism. I was having a discussion yesterday evening with a class at Wright State University, and we were talking a lot about how the internet has helped foster kind of an information overload where it's kind of difficult to discern, what information is really credible and what information is not. On the other hand, I think that as we learn more about how to be news literate in this new environment, you know, it also fosters kind of more opportunity to have access to a broader range of information than we have traditionally gotten from established news sources.
In a report by the FCC, it said that an abundance of voices does not guarantee an abundance of journalism. And the same report cited a study by JLab that showed that despite a plethora of new blogs, hyperlocal sites and collaborations, a virtual explosion of news outlets, the available news about Philadelphia public affairs issues had dramatically diminished.
Yeah, that's an interesting study. I'm not sure that that's a universal.
Okay.
It's a very challenging area to study and to make a determination right now because so much is in flux. I think a key element to think about when you talk about what's emerging as opposed to what's diminishing is the scale of what's being diminished, newspapers, other traditional media, is quite large. I worked at the Oregonian for about 20 years, and we had a newsroom of 400 people. Today, the Oregonian has a newsroom of 200 people,
mm-hmm.
So which is still not a small newsroom, obviously. But then, you know, you look at the news startup ecosystem, you know, what's emerging, and, you know, the bigger organizations might have 20 or 30 journalists working for them. A Texas Tribune, for example, which is a bigger nonprofit news site that covers state government, is probably operating. I don't have their most up-to-date figures, but, you know, a budget of maybe $2 million a year, which is not small money, but it's nothing on the scale of the budgets of traditional media. And then a lot of the new news outlets are one, two, or three people. So they're doing something valuable, and, you know, you can argue that ultimately there will be enough of them that, you know, there'll be a critical mass. But right now it's, you know, the scale is a real issue.
Question for our listeners. How do you get your local news? Are you satisfied with the local online content? What do they do? What do they do not so well, in your opinion? Give us a call. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, and you can tweet me at Ann Fisher WOSU. My guest is Michelle McClellan. She's a journalist and consultant who works on projects that help foster local news ecosystems. 2 years ago, she founded the Block by Block Community News Summit. It's a network of small entrepreneurial local news sites. I wanted to get at the idea of the flux, the diminishing number of traditional media, which forms the backbone, even still, of a lot of what's online today.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a bigger problem than all the other influx of sources? What kind of balance do you see striking there?
You know, it's hard to see how that's going to, everything is sort of hard to predict the future in this
right.
environment right now. I think that you're going to see a whole range of outcomes in traditional media because I think you have, a whole range of, strategies being tried out. I think leadership, newsroom, and, you know, the leadership of news organizations can play a huge role in determining how a particular news organization goes forward. So, you know, you're going to see in some communities, you're going to see a traditional news organization be able to sort of find its footing, perhaps not as the sort of mass general news source that it used to be, but as a, you know, as a place where it's doing a lot of investigation, it's creating unique content, so it's developing content that to which revenue might be attached, not necessarily a paywall, but you know, some model we haven't yet figured out where they can monetize against something they're creating that's very unique, or the community of users that they gather around that content. So that's something that could happen. I think other news organizations, especially in newspapers, you see, are still very invested in their print product. That's driving what they're doing because that's where they're still making most of their money, even though from advertising, print advertising, even though that money is diminishing every year. And the organizations are so consumed with that, the people in the newsroom, you know, are asked to be so preoccupied with that, that they, you don't necessarily see them building a future that is more innovative and more experimental and trying to figure out, you know, how are we going to keep doing good journalism, useful work online, you know, with fewer resources.
You know, sometimes I think of it as one of those rope bridges across a canyon.
Uh-huh.
And the bridge is unraveling. And
right.
The question is, can we get across the bridge
right.
before it unravels?
That is a great analogy. A similar one, a few years ago, Howard Weaver, who was the vice president then of news for McClatchy, which is a big newspaper chain, you know, referred to it as the burning bridge. It's, you know, getting across the burning bridge before it burns away. And it's, you know, it's very hard to tell right now, you know, what shape the bridge is in. I mean, I think it, you know, some people would argue that it's burned, you know. I hope that's not the case.
We're just walking among the rubble as we speak.
Well, yeah, I mean, we some of the organizations, you know, don't have a future, but it just hasn't become obvious yet.
How different does all of this, how much does the generational, do the generational differences come into play? Because there's a whole generation now of people that, a large number of them, they may look for, in fact, we know that they use their smartphones and their laptops and their tablets to look for news all the time. But that's different than spreading it out on the kitchen table in the morning and reading it with your family.
That's very true. And you know, I as I mentioned, I was at this class at Wright State last night, and I think of 12 or 13 people in the room. We asked them where they get their news, and I think only one, they were all relatively young, and only one said, well, actually, I do still read the newspaper. And, you know, he was even a little sheepish about it because it's so different from the rest of his age group. You know, I think this is part of the news literacy issue. I think that it's going to take the newspaper and, you know, some of the mainstream media are going away in many respects as sort of the dominant gatekeeper, you know, the organization or the that decides what news is worth everybody seeing every day or hearing about every day. It's not disappearing entirely, but it's got less, that sort of model has less and less influence.
It's somewhat paternalistic. We know what you need to know today.
Right, yeah, you can argue that. I mean, it's there's some good and some bad there, absolutely. You know, I think there's a lot of sort of exclusion in that model that you know, that was unfortunate, that, you know, I was very critical of when I was in newspapers. So I think it's a question of, you know, investing in, you know, sort of investing in figuring out what the best news sources are, you know, for the individual. To a certain extent, each individual has got to take some responsibility at this point, say, okay, where do I need to be going? You know, we were talking about this last night in the sense of, you can get a lot of headline news on, you know, CNN or one of the cable networks, but where do you say to yourself, okay, I've got all that, but how do I invest my time in finding, you know, deeper coverage and making a habit of reading it every week or whatever. You know, I think the current election cycle would be a great example where, you know, most of what you get is on, you know, on the big news outlets is sound bites, and, you know, half the time you can't figure out the context of the sound bites, you know, but there's good material out there on the issues and, you know, and reporting that, you know, public media is doing, newspapers are still doing, magazines. So it's a question of sort of taking responsibility for finding that.
To a certain extent, sometimes it feels like this proliferation of access is sort of like what reality TV is to cable, the cable era.
Mm-hmm.
They said, oh, we're going to have all these cable, there's going to be hundreds of cable channels, and you're going to have all that much more access to information.
Mm-hmm.
But what do we get? We get Jerseylicious.
Yeah, you know, that's a tough one. I mean, I always say just because people like dessert doesn't mean they still don't want the main course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think, you know, I like to think, I'm an optimist. I think people want access to, you know, some information, nutrition, along with the fluff. I mean, I'd be the first to say, you know, I look at the headlines in the National Enquirer when I'm in the grocery line. You know, it's not that I buy it or read it, but, you know, you get some, it's interesting, you know, we want to see what they're up to. So, you know, there's that element of we may have an exaggerated view of how people value some of the fluff. You know, it may not be all that they want, although it's certainly something that's appealing. You know, I think to some of this media, there's a certain addictive quality. You know, you can get real, I get from time to time really into Twitter, and I have to kind of pull back and say, well, wait a minute, you know, this is pretty limiting, even though I've been very careful about who I follow. I mean, I follow people who are really good sources of information about media and journalism and digital transformation. So, you know, I've invested in identifying those people, which is kind of what I was talking about.
Harold in North Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Harold.
Hi, thank you very much. I have a quick question about content. And since newspaper ownership is basically 1%, I'm wondering how much of content is self-interest, political, economic-driven kind of content and screening and editorializing.
Michelle McClellan?
In newspapers or in general?
Well, if you could talk to both, I would appreciate it, because I think there is a big element of that.
I think you're right, and I can't really quantify that. I have not seen that quantified. My impression would be that the amount of sort of the more opinionated kind of information is greater than it was, you know, when you had sort of the traditional newspaper, you know, media, broadcast media model, where opinion was sort of put in a particular place. So you might have 40 pages of a newspaper and 3 pages would be opinion. So there's definitely the sort of that impression that there's more opinion out there because more people can access, you know, the digital airwaves and get their opinions out there. I think the other factor, more than quantity, is this amplification issue. You know, so that if something is really catchy, whether it's, you know, valuable or not, it gets highly amplified on, you know, Twitter, Facebook, whatever. You know, more people can see it than could see it in the past when it might just be in one newspaper.
And what effect has that had on readership and consumers?
Again, I have not seen anything that has really studied that in depth. I mean, I think you could speculate that people potentially are becoming less informed.
Are they becoming less connected to that resource as an information source?
Yeah, and I think part of that is that we're in a transition from, you know, one fairly reliable, you know, source of information, or not just a single one, but, you know, traditional media, I would say, as a primary source it's reliable. You know, you could argue that it's not always, you know, fantastic. fantastic. It's not perfect, but you sort of know what it is, and it's, you know, the journalists are trying to do good work and making an attempt to be credible. And we're transitioning now to something different, and I don't think we've. Again, I'm an optimist. I feel like it's got the potential to come together, but we don't know. So it's definitely going to be more diverse sources. So the question is who pulls that together, and who guides us through that? And that might be a very good role for journalists. You know, it's in some cases called curation, where journalists are going out and identifying, not just reporting original news, but going out and identifying good sources of information and pulling, you know, their blogs together and pulling other news sources together so that, you know, readers like you can get a good, you know, broad-ranging, accurate perspective on a given story or issue.
Harold, thank you so much for that call. Michelle McClellan, can you stay with us?
Sure.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back, continue our conversation about online journalism and local online journalism. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the Supreme Court takes up the constitutionality of President Obama's health care reform. We'll have the High Court hearing on tape and top analysts on their deliberation. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point begins this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. And stay right here in just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Signs begins, and it's Tech Tuesday, a discussion of employers requiring Facebook passwords. Also, the latest on Google Voice and a new Supertooth Disco. That and more during Tech Tuesday from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the McCoy Center, presenting Capital Steps, celebrating 30 years of political satire, song parodies, and skits based on material pulled straight from the headlines. Friday, April 13th at the McCoy Center. Details at mccoycenter.org.
39 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a few clouds, a high near 58. There is a slight chance of rain for tonight, a low of 49 degrees. Rain likely tomorrow, a high of 72. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about the future of online journalism, sponsored by an event later this week at Ohio State University Moritz College of Law, which is sponsoring a two-day symposium called The Future of Online Journalism. Still with us is Michelle McClellan. She founded the Block by Block Community News Summit, a network of small entrepreneurial local news sites. Once again, Michelle, thanks for joining the show.
Sure, thank you.
Also with us is Jan Schaefer now. She's a former business editor and a Pulitzer Prize winner for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Jan left Daily Journalism in 1994 to lead pioneering initiatives in civic journalism, interactive and participatory journalism, and citizen media ventures at the J-Lab, a center of American University's School of Communications. Welcome to the show, Jan.
Thanks, Ann. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Drew.
Let's talk a little bit about hyper-local versus traditional local news. What do we mean by that, Jan?
Well, I think what we're seeing is there are huge gaps in coverage of just small-j journalism in communities around the country. Traditional news organizations do not have the feet on the street to do it anymore. And so you have either former journalists or civic catalysts, people involved in the community, now opting to create online news sites where they're attempting to cover breaking news, police news, education news, business news in their communities. Some are doing it as a hobby. Some are doing it as a business. But there are probably now more than 4,600 of these sites around the country doing various degrees of news and information that have journalistic DNA.
But are people looking at that and reading it and considering it as they would have 20 years ago, their daily newspaper?
I think where it's done credibly, yes, people are. I think in some instances, communities are getting coverage that they actually never had before from their daily news organizations because the organizations didn't have the resources to cover this. So you get hyperlocal sites now that are sometimes providing the only voters' guides in their communities. There would be no other way for their communities to know who to vote for. You get them doing candidate forums. You get them also doing some investigative work and investigative work that other media outlets around the state are picking up. So I think where there has been an aspiration to do journalism, these sites have a high degree of credibility.
Back in the early 80s when I got into the business, the newspaper business, there was a question about whether or not those zoned editions, those local editions of the larger daily newspaper
right.
would survive. They,
right.
they thought they wouldn't, and they did.
Well.
To a certain extent.
Some have. They're still, they still probably veer to the fluffy side of
yes.
journalism.
The local high school basketball tournament, that kind of thing.
Right, or a feature ad of something mm-hmm. or another. And I think that in the hyper-local news, I don't know that, you know, there are small items, short items. I wouldn't, I mean, there's some fluff, there's some events, but I think there's also an aspiration to do hard news. So I don't know that they're directly comparable to the zoned editions. I think there are their aspirations are really to connect with the community on a different level. I would also say, though, that some of these sites are advocating for the good of the community, which is something that traditional journalists are very uncomfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
But the new news sites are finding a connection with their audience in advocating for change or the good of the community. You have news sites, several now coming up covering public schools, and they cover it from a point of view that they're an advocate for good public schools. It's a bit of a different mindset. Their journalism is credible, but it's a different kind of convention than we're used to in standard journalism.
That's what we're used to in the journalism business, but do readers, are they missing something?
I don't, judging by commenting activity on some of these sites, not necessarily. I think in the case of the school sites that are coming up around the country, you know, you get a really invested community of parents and teachers, union members, administrators, taxpayers who kind of really want to know what's going on in the schools and what's working and what's not. And the coverage by being less dispassionate, more involved, is actually more engaging for some people.
What about the economics, Michelle McClellan?
The economics, as Dan and I both know, are very challenging
right.
On any scale. That's something we work a lot with in Block by Block and the summit. We're very focused on helping particularly the smaller for-profit sites, figure out revenue. I think there's sort of it's almost like a stepladder. A lot of the sites, as Jan said, are community-minded journalists who see the gaps, see the value that they can provide in the community in terms of news and information, and get in there and start sites. And they're good at the content, developing the content. That's what they know. The next thing they have to do is gain visibility. And that can be very challenging, especially for the smaller sites. You see in some places they develop content partnerships so that, their content is appearing on larger publications or at least, they're being linked back to. And I'll continue a little, but Jan has worked a lot with local news site networks, and she may want to talk a little bit about that. Then the third piece, of course, is, figuring out how to make money. And that is where most of these sites are extremely challenged. And it's partly because it's challenging to make money in any community, in any type of business.
Mm-hmm.
And these are essentially small businesses. But it's I think it's a particular challenge for journalists. That's what we're finding in Block by Block, is that they are so sort of, some of them take to it, but they're it's so culturally different from selling and that kind of thing and dealing with money and even doing accounting and sort of the basics of a business, that they really need a lot of help with that. You know, they need to figure it out themselves, or they need to get a partner. I think a lot of them are going to get there, but that is a big cliff that a lot of sites fall off of, is just not being able to come up with the money. I keep a database of sites that I say are working on all three legs of the stool. So they're doing content, they're doing community engagement, and they're doing revenue. And that's a significantly smaller number than the 4,600. And, that's not to say that what I'm looking at is the only model, mm-hmm. but I think it's kind of telling that relatively few are really making headway with revenue. So that's why we're trying to help them.
Jan Schaefer, what about those local news site networks that Michelle mentioned?
Well, I think we're finding that in any media ecosystem in a community, there are now several different players, and there's a lot of noise as well, and you don't need to reinvent the wheel, or you don't need to send three people out to cover the same thing. If you can begin to collectively agree to either curate, co-publish, or share reporting on stories, some of the many small parts can create quite a robust whole. And I think we're seeing that increasingly happen. Public media is now more open to collaboration. Mainstream media is getting there, although they're still very competitive. I think certainly the entrepreneurial startups are very open to collaboration, because they know they don't have the person power to be out there covering everything. Visibility helps. So if we do a project in Seattle where the Seattle Times now links to more than 46 other smaller news sites, no money changes hands,
mm-hmm.
But these news sites get an incredible boost in traffic. They get visibility. The Times, the Seattle Times, has an entryway for its readers to know about what's happening in communities around its region that it doesn't have reporters in. So it can be a win-win for a lot of the media players that are emerging now.
Jess and Powell, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jess.
Ah, thank you. I'm concerned about the lack of objective, investigative reporters as newsrooms dwindle. Sometimes the only thing that holds local government, judiciary, et cetera, in check and holds them accountable is the fact that they're scared to death that there might be somebody that's looking over their shoulder. And the fact that there aren't as many people in there, don't seem to have the kind of access, does not bode well for transparency in government.
Jan?
What I am very heartened by is that I think we're seeing in state by state now an investigative news site being launched that is particularly looking at state government issues. You have everything from the Texas Tribune to the Connecticut Mirror to Vermont Digger to Wisconsin Watch to Oklahoma Watch, California Watch, Florida Bulldog, on and on and on. We see investigative news sites that are doing really significant investigative journalism cropping up. Some of them are nonprofits. They're relying on either donors or foundations for their support, and that's a challenge for them. And they would welcome, I think, support from a broader readership in their communities. on a hyperlocal basis, I think several of the smaller news sites are getting there, but it's really hard to have the resources to do, whether it's database analysis or pulling the thread on stories that public officials don't want to have in the open. But what they say is that just their presence at municipal meetings makes a difference. Public officials are aware that they're there. They start behaving differently. And in some cases, like in Newcastle Now in New York, when they're not there at the meetings, public officials kind of say, where were you? You know, the cities have begun to rely on some of the smaller news sites to help get out information in a snowstorm and some kind of crisis that's happening. So, you know, it's a slow process. It merits support where it's well done from the local community. None of this is free. You know, even the gas money that people have to pay to cover municipal meetings is coming out of their pockets. So, you know, it's something worthy of support.
Michelle, you want to wrap it up?
Well, just I would just echo what Jan says. I mean, I think that we're really getting things are starting to shape up in terms of seeing that, you know, in different states areas there are investigative sites coming up. There are more and more of these, you know, highly local community-focused news sites. Other actors are coming in. I mean, nonprofits are providing perfectly good news and information. Libraries are starting to come in and take a greater role in meeting news and information needs in their communities. So you can look at the whole field and, you know, think this is very chaotic and I can't figure out what's going on and this is very discouraging because I see some sites going under. But I really feel like what we're seeing is, you know, the beginnings of a real renaissance, potentially, of local news and information.
Michelle McClellan, thank you. Thank you so much. And also, Jan Schaefer, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.